I'm Effie Parks. Welcome to Once Upon a Jane, the podcast. This is a place I created for us to connect and share the stories of our not-so-typical lives. Raising kids who are born with rare genetic syndromes and other types of disabilities can feel pretty isolating. What I know for sure is that when we can hear the triumphs and challenges from others who get it, we can find a lot more laughter, a lot more hope, and feel a lot less alone. I believe there are some magical healing powers that can happen for all of us through sharing our stories, and I'll take all the help I can get.
Once Upon a Jane is proud to be part of Bloodstream Media. Living in a family affected by rare and chronic illness can be isolating, and sometimes the best medicine is connecting to the voices of people who share your experience. This is why Bloodstream Media produces podcasts, blogs, and other forms of content for patients, families, and clinicians impacted by rare and chronic diseases. Visit bloodstreammedia.com to learn more.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the show. This is Once Upon a Jane, and I'm your host, Effie Parks. And I kind of feel like Carmen Sandiego right now. I am jet-setting from one impactful event to another already this year. As this episode airs, I'm wrapping up a little visit and workshop hosted by the one and only Alexion and Patient Authentic from Boston. And then I'll be heading off World Orphan Drug with my friends at GeneDx to talk about genetic testing. Fingers crossed for a stop at the $1 million bike ride in Philly if childcare aligns. CTNNB1 has been chosen as one of the teams, and we're so excited. Stay tuned for a follow-up little episode about the $1 million bike ride. And then I'm going to join forces with my friends at Dravet in Minnesota for their conference. And then I am going to Slovenia for the CTNNB1 International Research Conference. So lots of stuff happening in the next couple months over here. I can't wait to see so many of your faces. It's like the brightest spot of this community. I love it so much. Okay, so I hope that by mentioning Carmen Sandiego, all of you have that tune stuck in your head for the rest of the day. But not before you listen to today's episode, where I get to speak with two rad women who are doing groundbreaking work at the Rare Epilepsy Network, also referred to as REN. So I'm thrilled to welcome these two women, and they are so full of energy, and you better get a piece of paper and a pen out because you're going to learn a lot. Their bios are really extensive. They've both been founders and co-founders, and they counsel and all around badasses. So if you want to learn more about them, go to the rareepilepsynetwork.org, click the About page, and read all about them because they are just doing incredible work. So without further ado, let's get into this episode. Please welcome my special guests, Eileen Miller and Christina San Inocencio. Hello, Eileen and Christina. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much. Great to be here.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to chatting with both of you and getting your message out and talking about Rare Epilepsy Network and kind of the inception of not just REN, but also the both of you. So please give me a little introduction. I'll start with you, Eileen.
We're just delighted to be here also. We love your podcast and all the work that you're doing to just raise awareness of the rares and especially the epilepsies. My son was diagnosed after a 5-year diagnostic odyssey, and we just hear this story over and over again. You know, new parents, oftentimes their first child, and you're seeing things that look peculiar for us. Our son, as a newborn, was smiling all the time and giggling all the time and staring all the time, sort of having these spells where he just seems spaced out. And we just thought, wow, he's a really unusually happy baby. And when we would mention it to his doctors, you know, they would say, new parents, you know, it all sounds normal to us. And it literally wasn't until he was 5. He was actually at an ice skating rink with my husband. He fell down and he couldn't get up. And my husband, who's a doctor, suddenly realized, oh my God, he's having a seizure. That sent us down the course to meet with a neurologist and have an MRI. And truthfully, everything came back normal. And because my husband had trained at that hospital, the radiologist came out and spoke with us. And when we described these peculiar staring, laughing, giggling, smirking, smiling spells at the time that he was having, the radiologist actually took a second look. And it was on that second look that he saw what is a very small non-cancerous tumor called a hypothalamic hamartoma. And that gave us a diagnosis. And when we began reading about that and learning about that, everything started to make sense. And that was the beginning of my journey as a parent and also a professional from the nonprofit space to help found an organization to bring together other families that had also received that diagnosis. And that's a story that I know you can relate to. I know Christina can relate to, and so many others, that it starts, you know, with a personal experience. You're driven to find your tribe or your community. And then in doing so, you are surrounded by people where you have so many shared experiences and learnings.
Oof. Yeah. I mean, so much of that, I think everyone can relate to, or so many. I mean, even me, like the staring spells and the laughing spells and the gaslighting of a new parent, right? And then feeling like you did make a mistake because you didn't push hard enough or you didn't notice the right things.
The guilt, for sure, for sure.
Boo. Okay, thanks for sharing that, Eileen. How about you, Christina?
So thank you again for inviting us to be on. So my story started when I was 7 years old. I have a younger brother, Michael, who's 4 years younger than I am. And he was typically developing, but at the age of three and a half, he just all of a sudden had a tonic-clonic seizure. The first of what we didn't know at the time would be, you know, tens of thousands of seizures in his lifetime. That set us on sort of a journey of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. It did take 2 years for him to get that formal LGS diagnosis. And we live in the New York City tri-state area. So you would think that we would have access to, you know, the leading epilepsy centers and neurologists at the time, which we did, but it still took 2 years for him to fit that criteria of LGS. Fast forward, Michael is now 36 years old. And only last year we received a genetic diagnosis for him, which explains his LGS. His genetic diagnosis is Kleefstra syndrome. The gene is EHMT1. It's a chromatin remodeler gene. But until, you know, about 18 months ago, we did not know the cause of his LGS. With that story said, it was in late 2007, early 2008, when I realized that there was a desperate, considerable need for community around LGS families. And so I founded the LGS Foundation in November 2007. We were officially incorporated in early 2008. And then I served as first president and then executive director until 2020. So I've been in the rare epilepsy space almost my whole entire life, you know, as an advocate for almost 20 years. And I've also worked alongside Eileen in a number of different capacities on a number of different projects. And that's what really brought us together today on this podcast and our connection to Ren.
Ugh, that's so cool. I love a sibling story so much. I have so much respect for that sword that you pick up in your family. And thank you for creating the LGS Foundation. If you want to hear more about it, there's episode 207 with Tracy Dixon Salazar, who's now the executive director. And I know they're just really helping to support families who are having kids with such severe seizures. Just out of curiosity, Christina, can I ask about the genetic testing and how it happened so late? Or had you just revisited it for your brother? Or like, how did that transpire?
He had not received genetic testing as a child or a teenager, just because it really wasn't widely available at that time. But he was involved in the Epi4K study, which was the precursor to EpGEP, which was the precursor to Epi4K. And even with those genetic tested, there was a whole exome sequencing, nothing was found. And so we tried to revisit and tried to get data back. We were not successful. And then it wasn't until my mom had essentially pushed a new neurologist to revisit genetic testing, and a panel had picked up the new gene. Or not new, but new to us.
Oh my gosh, that's so amazing. And I love that your mom's still pounding the pavement and like advocating.
She sure is.
Wow. Yes. Check the adults. Get genetic testing on the adults.
Oh my gosh, I can't stress that enough. It's incredible what it means as an adult, right? To receive that genetic diagnosis.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that it's not a one and done too, right? That it's something that, like, within Christina's instance and others, you've got to revisit it. You know, if you have it as an adult and nothing gets turned up, don't take that as a, well, there's nothing there. Take that as a, you've done it once. Now, within an appropriate time, do it again. We're big proponents of that for sure.
Amen. We need to have a conference on this.
Yes, we do.
Oh my gosh. Okay, well, we'll revisit that conversation in another episode. Today, we're going to talk about the Rare Epilepsy Network. So first, I want to know, like, I know people are going to go, okay, well, why the Rare Epilepsy Network? I know there's a couple other things that talk about epilepsy in other groups. So what was the gap between some standing epilepsy foundations that people might just automatically think of and the gap that you filled by positioning REN there?
I'll just take a step backwards and I will absolutely describe the network. But I think it's important also to describe, you know, this Christina and I were part of the early founding of it. And it was really the first time that my organization that I helped to co-found, Hope for Hypothalamic Hamartoma, back in 2009, I believe it was that year, went to our very first American Epilepsy Society meeting. And at that time, there was an organization then called Vision 2020 that included both the kind of big organizations representing the epilepsies in this space. So epilepsies like Epilepsy Foundation and Cure Epilepsy, but also sitting at the table were organizations like Tuberous Sclerosis Complex and Lennox-Gastaut Syndrome. And I think it was, if not one of Christina's first, you had only been there maybe just a year or two at that point. And Christina was so warmly welcoming of me, you know, newbie in this meeting and in this environment, hadn't been to a conference for the epilepsies like this. It was pretty overwhelming. I know a lot of organizations and leaders out there can, you know, relate to that as well. And so it began this conversation. And at the time, there were just a few individual disorder organizations sitting around that table. Flash forward 3 years later, we're back at AAS again, because that's what we do, right? Every year in December, all of our organizations go to AES and we're building these relationships, leading these conversations. And I will never forget, it was in San Diego, Christina and I and several other leaders of these rare organizations were sitting in a hallway and we were all lamenting that we had all made an application for a federal funded grant to create a registry for our diseases. And we had all been declined and we were bummed. And it occurred to us sort of at that time that, well, maybe if we had combined our efforts, we would have been successful as a block of rare epilepsies versus LGS, HH, TSC, sort of all these others. And so that was really that conversation in that hallway with those other leaders was sort of the seed that then sparked conversations with organizations like the Epilepsy Foundation and others that had the resources to make an application for a grant. And so REN at the time was really born out of the need of so many of our organizations needing more information about our constituents and their experiences and not being able to secure the funds to do that for ourselves. So ultimately, 10 organizations, just like HH, just like LGS, got together with Epilepsy Foundation, Research Triangle Institute, and Columbia, and we put together a PCORI application, and we were awarded $3 million, and that was in 2013. To create what became the first ever rare epilepsy network registry. And it was a registry that wasn't examining specifically one disease, but that had the capacity to collect information across all of the rare epilepsies. We started off with 10 organizations, and through the development of the project, we grew to include 32 different organizations. Imagine that, working together, gathering information. And the information that we were gathering included everything, you know, the cause, the seizure types, the medications, the different comorbidities, so many other types of information. And over the course of 5 years, 1,500 caregiver reported information, you know, was collected. And I think probably, and Christina can also reflect on the learnings, but I think perhaps the biggest learning that came out of it was that beyond the cause, there were so many shared symptoms. I think we were each sitting in our silos and we were all thinking, well, I'm the only organization that has behaviors or rages, or I'm the only organization and disorder that has 20 different types of seizures, or we're the only community that is suffering from pneumonia or sleep effects. And what we began to learn through the information that was discovered in this registry was that many of those shared challenges cut across all of the rare epilepsies. It was like a huge epiphany. and huge new understanding for our community.
Ooh, that makes me tingle. I mean, the conversations in the hallway, right?
Oof. Yeah.
Curious, that first grant that you were all denied for, did anyone get it? And was it just someone random?
Yeah, not in the rare epilepsy space. Other organizations were awarded the initial grant, but there were other forms, you know, other rare diseases. But it definitely lit a fire under all of us and really began that collaboration that continues today, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, that is such a significant milestone achieved through like desperate collaboration, right?
Yeah.
I love it so much. Can you talk a little bit about the process of forming these partnerships with all these other groups and like how you convinced them to get on board and make it sort of like one think tank? Obviously, I know you were talking to the people in the hallway who like had that epiphany with you, but sometimes people do get so protective of their silos. Some people have founder syndrome and some people think that if I join you, I'll lose out on money. So how did you sort of nurture that community and ignite people to join in?
Yeah, I think it happened pretty naturally, actually. I think the organizations that came together in the beginning, again, were coming together just out of sort of desperation and everyone was motivated. And then as more and more organizations joined, and Eileen, you know, speak up if you remember differently, but I think it really happened just very naturally and through sort of word of mouth, like, hey, this is what we're trying to do. And other organizations got really excited about it and got behind it as well. And so I really look back and see this as a beautiful example of collaboration within the rare epilepsies, because everybody really, I don't think that there were any egos involved. And I don't think that there were any sort of negative or I should say there was, in my opinion, no real resistance to joining and getting behind this. And then it really flourished from there. Eileen, do you have anything to add?
No, 100%. I think there was such a need for this resource, and none of our organizations, you know, had the capacity to do it for ourselves, or very few of the organizations had the wherewithal to do it for themselves. And truthfully, even those that did, there were a couple in the space that already had a registry. Tuberous sclerosis comes to mind, but they were so eager to learn across the rares. And I think that was a beautiful thing too, is that in the development of the tools, that became the survey that the caregivers and in some instances the patients completed, it became such an incredibly robust survey, because instead of it focusing on the experience of just one community, we had the benefit of these, you know, original 10 communities sort of weighing in. And it got us thinking more broadly about what is the symptomatology. And I think, you know, this really was a turning point across the rare epilepsies. And I think there was a lot of movement sort of publicly as well, like, you know, the seizures stink, they suck for our families, they are awful, but they are not the only symptom. And in some instances, the seizures were the least worrisome of the concerns. It was all the other, you know, the behaviors, the rages, the, you know, the other health challenges that these rare epilepsies were presenting that were the more severe concerns. And that was really shared across our groups. But there was very little resistance. I think groups were delighted to participate. And truthfully, when the project came to an end in 2019, the funding ran out, the registry closed. It's still available today. And we can make that the link available if researchers or other people listening want access to that data. It's still a robust data set, but we get asked all the time, you know, can I participate in that registry? Because unfortunately, the problem of many more organizations and a lack of resources to create these robust registries is still very prevalent today.
Yeah, that's so frustrating. The registry, what, included 1,500 patient caregivers? Over 40 disorders. I love what you said about how many voices got brought into sort of the decision making around what types of questions to ask and what kind of concerns that are actually affecting the families in front, right? Like, because you imagine that this is the worst thing and that's the thing that everyone wants fixed. But when you actually ask the families, ask the people who are taking care of these people, it can be wildly different. And that goes to show that like you can't make something for us without asking us.
That's right. Effie, it's so important to say that, because this was, again, I think Christina's saying a beautiful example. It really was a beautiful example. This was done in collaboration with very thoughtful researchers. A lot of the groups that had scientists and medical advisors certainly were contributing, but this is first and foremost the patients and the caregivers driving the registry, the questions that were asked, and the conversation. And as a result, it was inclusive of things that had it been driven in a different way, it might not have been. And I think, you know, we're very proud of that. And it doesn't mean that the registry was perfect. Trust me, anybody that was involved in it, we could all find, you know, many ways that we could have improved it, that we would do differently if we had an opportunity to do it again. But it really did signify a turning point in our community that we had more in common than we did, you know, that differentiated us from each other.
Yeah. I wish there was a way for like all of our ultra rare disease community members to kind of figure out this collaboration and this partnership in a big way like that, right? It sounds like a wonderland, but I'm not sure how much it makes sense really in practicality. What advice do you both have for organizations or people seeking to establish sort of similar collaborative efforts in the realm of our rare disease world? Like what advice would you give to them if they're thinking about joining forces with like umbrella groups?
Yeah, and that really is the beauty of REN today, right? So just to finish out the story, in 2019, the registry funding had run out, the registry, you know, activity or initiative came to an end. But a bunch of leaders were still sitting around the table. Then we were up to 32 groups. We were all looking at each other and we were like, we have so much more that we can and should be doing together. And so it's almost like REN 2.0 was born in 2019 when we transitioned from being a project, just simply a registry focused project, to a network that would serve as a collaborator, a convener of all of the different disorders that had epilepsy as a symptom. And within short order, we, you know, by 2020, we were at 50 organizations. And now in 2024, we are over 100 organizations that are all participating, yeah, under this umbrella. We are onboarding, just this morning, we onboarded an organization. We probably onboard 2 to 3 organizations a month, if not more, that are finding us or we're finding them. They are, you know, disorder focused, but they have seizures as a comorbidity and they're looking for that partnership and that collaboration. And that's really what the REN, you know, 2.0 network offers organizations today. And Christina can elaborate on all the different ways that we enrich members of our network. And frankly, they enrich us as a network.
Yeah, please, Christina, break off onto that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll just go back and talk about just the growth to see 2 to 3 members a month. And it is, in fact, more than that. Eileen, I think last month we had like 6. And by the way, I'm responsible for adding every new organization that comes into this graphic, and we are running out of room. So that's going to be, we're going to need to revise that completely soon. But but it's incredible because as we see more and more genetic testing not only become available, but new genes being discovered, we see, you know, this motivation from families to do what Eileen and I have done, you know, did almost 2 decades ago. And it's incredible to see how much growth there is in really the genetic epilepsies, and for families to be able to identify the gene that is causing their child's epilepsy. I mean, I know the feeling just because it's fresh in my mind 18 months ago. It's just incredible. And so if they have a place to go after they receive that genetic diagnosis, you know, into another organization that is established specifically for either research in the gene or advocacy or just even support, then that's a win for the families that are receiving the diagnosis. And then REN, which is providing, again, what Eileen said, an umbrella for all of these organizations, we serve as the collaborator. And I know that, you know, some organizations, and Eileen has touched on this, might feel a little bit intimidated when first starting an organization. They might feel overwhelmed. There's so much to sort of navigate in starting a new organization. But if we as a network can provide those resources or at least connect them to other organizations who have sort of been there, done that, and can mentor them, it makes that process so much easier. And so I know I didn't answer your question at all, but I just wanted to sort of touch on that growth because it really is incredible to see.
Yeah. It It really is. I mean, the momentum that's happening is swift. Like you said, I mean, CTN MB1 joined just a couple months ago. My friend Rodney Smocko was like, why aren't you on Ren? I'm like, I don't know, because we've been gaslit for so long that we are in a seizure disorder. But then like all of these new kids, and my own included, keep popping up and they're having seizures. And it's finally like we're getting enough patients that we can actually like kind of put our stake there and be like, this is us and we belong here. And we also need this kind of guidance and help because we haven't been talking about it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we find also, I mean, even among our members, you know, what unites our members is that they all have epilepsy. Some of their populations have 100%. Some of their populations have, you know, 1%, but they have seizures as a common symptom. And I think the interesting thing too is that when members become part of REN and they start to learn more about seizures, this is sort of unfortunate, but we have had groups that came in and they thought, well, 100% of our population doesn't have seizures. And all of a sudden they're learning from all these other members about nighttime seizures or staring seizures or laughing seizures or crying seizures or all different kinds of flavors of seizures. And they begin to realize that actually things that maybe they were writing off as other behaviors or spells or whatever actually were seizures, and that the percentage of their population that has some of these seizure types actually increases as well. So we hope that, not that we're looking for more disorders to have more symptoms, but we certainly do want parents to be aware, you know, especially of all the different types of seizures that there are, so that they can be prepared with seizure action plans, with, you know, seizure rescue medication, that they have an understanding of SUDEP and some of the causes of, you know, mortality or the more severe injuries that can occur from seizures themselves.
Yeah. I mean, the education surrounding it, it just makes me think of like the word grief, right? And that so many people think that they can't use that word to describe something unless there's been a death. And in seizures, I feel like especially families in the beginning don't necessarily feel like they can identify with epilepsy if there isn't a drop seizure or something like that. And so it just gets missed.
That's right. That's right. The other thing I wanted to mention too is that we've, Christina and I both have talked a lot about the genetic epilepsies, and certainly those are the ones that are, you know, getting diagnosed fast and furious because of the advances in the genetic testing. But I would be remiss to say, or not to say, that there are many causes of rare epilepsies. There are structural causes. So tuberous sclerosis and hypothalamic hamartomas are good examples of disorders, rare disorders that have epilepsies that also are sort of structural in nature. There are injuries that can cause a rare epilepsy. So HIE, H-I-E is one of our partners that represents an injury that oftentimes happens at birth. There are metabolic epilepsies. So GLUT1, you know, is an example, and also an example of a rare epilepsy that has an intervention that the keto diet can help many of the patients in that community. There are immune-related rare epilepsies, and there are also infection-related rare epilepsies. So, you know, one of the take-homes we hope for anybody listening to this podcast is that if you get a diagnosis of epilepsy, that is not enough. You need to ask the next question, which is, what is the underlying cause? And the cause could be genetic, and you should explore opportunities for repeated genetic testing, but there could be many of these other types of causes underlying your rare epilepsy as well. And it's just important to make sure that, you know, you're getting treated and evaluated at an advanced center like those that are level 4. The National Association for Epilepsy Centers maintains a state list where you can look and see all the different centers in your state that have that higher level understanding of the epilepsies and certainly of the rare epilepsies.
Yeah, Eileen, that's a great point. Thank you for bringing that up. Even with Lennox-Gastaut as an example, which I'm sure Tracy talked about, right? And how it's such a heterogeneous disorder. Well, the same thing goes for the Rare Epilepsy Network or those organizations that are represented within REN. It's not just genetic epilepsies. There are many different causes to these rare epilepsies. So Eileen, I think you explained that beautifully.
Yeah, thanks for putting a pin in that, both of you. That's so important to ask the next question, right? And that goes along with so many of the symptomatology stuff across rare diseases, right? When you get thrown in buckets, but there's another question or there's another genetic test, and to just keep searching and make sure that you're finding places like REN so you can become more informed. informed and better advocate for your loved one. Wow. Well, your growth and evolution is really impressive. I mean, transitioning from a project to a standalone network that's doubled, maybe tripled in size. I think that's really cool. And I love the inception story of that. Let's talk about how you engage the community and how you do this continued support. Like, what are the key factors that contribute to this growth? And let's talk about all those monthly meetings and all these emails I see now that are just so, they're so cool because they're like chat room style, but they're not an annoying email either. So let's talk about sort of that whole foundation that you've set up.
Yeah. So, you know, when we evolved from the registry to the standalone network, we had to sort of build in infrastructure. And we realized right off the bat that monthly meetings, bringing our members together, and not just for the sake of talking to each other, all that's lovely too. There's a lot of, you know, folks that we've all come to love and appreciate in this community. But we pulse, we survey our members on a regular basis. We want to know what is top of mind for them. And we bring in extraordinary researchers and speakers and partners and other organizations so that we're not wasting anybody's time with these meetings that we have each month. We're bringing information to our members that they can use, in their own organizations with their own constituents. I mean, just some examples. We brought in the Undiagnosed Disease Network late last year so they could talk to us about the process that they go through of identifying some of these genes. And then they are aware of us, so they can make referrals to their newly diagnosed populations to us. And same thing, if we have families that are coming to REN that are saying, we just can't get a diagnosis, we are aware of the resources for them. Most recently, we had panelists come and talk with us about mortality. And it's such a hard topic to talk about. But if you can imagine all 100 of our organizations, each individually dealing with this in their own communities, how do you educate about it? What do you do if somebody passes? And what we did was we set up a panel. We brought in some people that have some experience to really share best practices, to share resources. We're actually looking to put together a working group so that all of our members that are interested can work on this collaboratively, can share those resources and make it available to the rest of the network. And in doing so, that saves everybody time. It minimizes redundancy. It helps us learn from the groups that maybe are more mature and more advanced and have already figured this stuff out so that the newer groups aren't recreating the wheel. And anything that we can do that saves our members time and effort, that's really what we're all about in regards to, you know, our meetings as one example. We also have a listserv, and maybe Christina, you want to talk a little bit about the listserv.
Yeah, so the listserv is sent, it's compiled with all of the members that are members of REN, and anybody at any point can ask any type of question related to rare epilepsy. And the discussion that sort of happens very naturally from those posts, and then, you know, sort of somebody makes a post and then there's a response, and then usually it turns into a longer thread. The information within these discussions is gold. I can't even tell you. If this was a resource to me when first starting the LGS Foundation, it would have been, again, a gold mine. Things like collaborative opportunities, grant mechanisms, questions about IRB protocol, confidentiality, questions just about how do we sort of navigate this one situation? Have you been there, done that? And then getting the responses from other groups. I think it's really, it's very engaging, but it's incredibly helpful for newer organizations like we've been mentioning. So the listserv is super active. I would say, Eileen, you probably have a better gauge on how many actual posts go through the listserv, but it's probably about at least a dozen a month. And then it's archived. So at any point, if you were thinking, so if I was a new organization and I was curious about maybe drafting a bylaws, although most organizations have bylaws at this point, but I'm just going to use that as an example. Other organizations might upload their bylaws so other organizations can see. And again, it's this collaborative environment where people can learn from each other. It's incredibly helpful.
Oh, yes. Keep working on that. I love that.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to mention too is that, and we'll talk about our newsletter also, but we also offer what we call sort of like our information and referrals. So we field multiple questions a week, and they could come from researchers, academics, clinicians, industry, as well as patients and families and persons touched by the epilepsies. And it could be something like, I was just diagnosed with X. Is there an organization for me? In which instance we, you know, immediately refer them out to the to our organizational partners to let them know, yeah, there are resources. This is where your tribe is. Connect with this group. If there's not a group, we'll ask them to for their permission to sort of hold on to their information. And so sometimes we're matchmaking behind the scenes. I'll get contacted by two different families that have both been impacted by a newly diagnosed disorder, and they're looking for their tribe. They haven't found it yet. And with each of their permission, we will connect them behind the scenes. And the same thing is happening. Clinicians will contact us. Is there a patient organization for this disorder, or are there resources for, you know, these symptoms? And so we are constantly in touch with all of these communities to try to connect the dots. And again, we see ourselves as the intermediary to quickly pass them off to get them connected to the people that are going to have the most up-to-date information about research, clinical trials, support, programming, community, you know, opportunities to participate in conferences or come together. The other thing I wanted to mention too was that we as a network are not just available to organizations that are formally as, you know, organizations like 501c3 nonprofit organizations. If a group is a support group or a Facebook support group, we have space for those groups as well within our network. So it is not a requirement to be a formal 501c3 to be part of the REN network, because we realize that a lot of these groups are being founded, you know, by parents, by caregivers that may not be equipped to formalize the structure of their organization. And we don't want to exclude groups that are providing community and support for broader based families. And then I also just wanted to mention our newsletter, which we put out once a month. It's a team effort across our REN leadership, and hopefully it includes information about, you know, all the latest news in REN. Shout outs to all of our members and all the great work that they're doing. We'll certainly refer to this podcast in there when it broadcasts, but it really is a source that goes out not just to our members, but to academics, to industry, to clinicians. And we keep hearing repeatedly from, you know, a lot of our partners in this space how valuable it is to have all of this information consolidated in one place, and how much they appreciate seeing what all the different organizations are up to. We celebrate organizations' awareness days. We track the resources. We watch our leaders that are, you know, playing leadership roles, not just in the rare epilepsies, but in the space at large. I'll give a shout out recently, you know, several leaders, Nasha Fitter from Fox G1 and Charlene Sohn Rigby, who's both with STX BP1 and Global Genes, were also invited to the White House during Rare Disease Week. They both gave awesome testimony about rare disease and rare epilepsies. And that's just two examples of leaders from this space that are making their mark on a national platform and also very active members of the rare epilepsies.
And I'll just add, while we're on the subject of the newsletter, the newsletter has a really high open rate. So it's 65%, which with newsletters is extremely high. I mean, an open rate of 20% is usually considered pretty strong. So to see that 65% of members actually open and read the newsletter is very encouraging. I also want to mention that our listserv grew in 2023 by almost 50%. So I think those numbers, again, speak to the growth of the network.
Wow, that was so chock full of important information. Thank you both so much for sharing it. I feel you as being a connector through Once Upon a Gene for sure. And now REN is on my list as a resource to share for families too when they come to me. And I especially love when you mentioned that there's no hierarchy in belonging and in the development of process of your disease group, and that anyone can join who's trying to help their loved ones and to figure it all out. So that's really very cool. And then another thing, when you were talking about the mortality subject and not recreating the will, but offering these supports, I'm thinking you must talk to the Courageous Parents Network, because they can help you partner on those kinds of topics and issues. They've done all the work and they're so flawless at it. So I hope you can connect with them for future conversations surrounding that type of support for families.
Yeah, for sure. They're an amazing resource.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just flawlessly done. Okay, cool. Well, let's talk about the future directions and kind of what are some major goals that you have top of mind in the near future.
Yeah, we'd be happy to. And I think I also just want to mention the leaders that lead REN, and then I promise I'll go over to what our plans are, but I think it ties together because they're the people that are helping drive. So we have a committee right now at what we call a coordinating committee. There are 7 leaders on it. We have representatives from the Epilepsy Foundation and from Cure of Epilepsy, and they have sort of a standing spot. And I think it's demonstration of their strong commitment and awareness of the rare epilepsies. And those leaders liaison back within their much larger organizations to make sure that their staff and their boards and their communities are aware of what's happening in the rares too. So we really value their partnership and their participation. We have 5 other leaders that each represent a specific rare disorder, and these are rotated. So they serve 2 years. Christina is our new chairperson, Karen Utley with an organization called IFCR representing the CDKL5 gene is our vice chair. And, you know, shout out to all of the leaders of the Rare Epilepsy Network, because these are oftentimes, you know, parents or siblings. They have full-time day jobs, very busy day jobs. They're oftentimes caring for very critically and complex, you know, siblings or loved ones, children, parents, or adults. They are running each their own organization, disease organizations, as volunteers alongside other volunteers. And on top of all of that, they're stepping up now to serve in a leadership capacity of REN. And I just can't say enough about their leadership, their commitment, their compassion, and all that they, you know, give back to these communities. They really are. Right now, there are many women leading, also a lot of men as well. The current CC is comprised of all women, and they really are the rock star women in our community. As far as our, you know, our plans, as said we earlier, we pulse our members to get, you know, what is most important to them. And 2 years ago, we focused on multidisciplinary clinics. We heard across from all of our members that there are not enough of them. The ones that exist are not measuring their efficacy in ways that are meaningful. We need more accountability for what they're doing. We need more inclusivity of the ways in which they're operating. And so we undertook a deep dive into multidisciplinary clinics. We organized 2 meetings during the annual American Epilepsy Society conference, where we brought together literally 100 researchers, clinicians, and patient advisory group leaders. It's one of the only times or few times that we're aware of when all of these people are in the same room talking about a common problem and working on solutions. And so we're continuing to dialogue and put out resources in regard to that problem and that challenge. And we're pleased to see, like, Houston recently, University just launched a new rare epilepsy clinic for one of the disorders that are a part of our membership, which is fantastic news. And we hope that more institutes will take on more of these to make multidisciplinary care available to our communities. This year, we're focused on clustering, and I will pass it off to Christina to talk a little bit more about that initiative and other things that we're doing.
Yeah, so this initiative came out of again, just conversations between the members, and we realized probably a long time ago, actually, that a lot of the disorders that REN represents share quite certainly symptoms, but also other things beyond what has really been reported in the literature and even in the registry. And so we wanted to sort of look at all of the rare epilepsies from more of a clustering standpoint. And what I mean by that is, again, looking at etiology, looking at channels, looking at symptoms, and figuring out where there could be synergy based on these commonalities. And so we had the breakfast. So every year, REN hosts either a breakfast or a lunch at AES. Just this past December was a breakfast. And the focus was, again, looking across all the rare epilepsies. And we had a panel that presented, and the panel was essentially broken down into, and Eileen, just help me out here. So the one panelist was Dennis Lal, who actually collected data and analyzed that and looked at exactly what we're talking about. And then we had two other speakers who were part of consortia, two different consortia who had really discussed their experiences of working across multiple rare epilepsies. And then who am I missing, Eileen?
Yeah, no. So we had a doctor that is leading research across the mTOR pathway, and that includes at least three different flavors of rare epilepsies. And he talked about his consortia. He's based in out of Boston, Mass General and Boston Children's Hospital. We had one of our colleagues from Longboard, which is another industry partner, and they actually have in development a therapeutic that cuts across all of the developmental epileptic encephalopathies. And so this is really novel. Usually drugs target a particular diagnosis like LGS or CDKL5, but in this instance, their therapy, if you meet the criteria for DEE for short, then you would be eligible to take this therapy. And so, you know, again, we were thrilled to have one of our industry partners come and talk about a novel way of developing a therapeutic. And then the third was actually Kate Sill, who works by day with the Phelan-McDermid Syndrome Foundation, but undertook a project that cut across gastro concerns. So this particular project called Candid got funding, and it included many rare epilepsies as well as neurodevelopmental disorders that all had in common the symptoms, you know, gastrointestinal symptoms, and reported on their work. And so, you know, back to Christina's point, you know, there are many ways to slice and dice, and we're so used to looking at things very narrowly, looking at disorders very narrowly. And what we're trying to do is broaden the way that we're discussing these disorders. And we even had Dr. Koroshetz, who's the director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorder and Strokes, make a surprise visit and actively engage in our meeting and this discussion. And he showed tremendous enthusiasm for the ways in which we were thinking out of the box very creatively across all of these stakeholders about the future of the rare epilepsies.
Yeah, that's very cool. I love that it is a true collaboration too, right? Again, to use that word, it's not just thinking so narrowly, but you're like, oh, yes, I hear you. There's a seed, plant it. There's a seed, plant it. And then watching this all grow and kind of connect to each other is really, really inspirational. I love it. I think a lot of people could take heed.
Thank you.
Okay, my last question's two-part. For the groups that are already members of REN, what are they maybe not utilizing that they should be? Or maybe what do they not know about it? And then for newcomers listening, where and how and why should they onboard?
Great, great questions. Maybe we can both take a stab at it. So I think for the members, I would love to see more activity on our social media. And I would love to see more people using the hashtag rare epilepsies in everything that they post. So if any syndromes or disorders have epilepsy as a symptom, just use the post and the hashtag rare epilepsies, because I think that is how, once again, we're going to build, you know, public awareness, awareness among professionals. And I think that hashtag and sort of that mechanism and that public awareness raising opportunity is largely underutilized. I think for the newcomers, I mean, you know, if you're listening and your organization or your support group is not a part of REN, please reach out to us and we'll engage in a conversation. There's no cost to be a member of REN. It's 100% free, and you can engage at the pace that's right for you. So we have our Uber REN members who are engaged and serve on every committee and very active in our work groups. And, you know, we really appreciate that. And we also have members that, you know, are sort of watching and learning and taking information and sharing as it's appropriate. And I'll just say one more thing. Our member meetings, which happen every monthly, are very actively engaged. We have probably 50 plus leaders of organizations attending these meetings, sharing insights, and actively participating. So for the members that aren't coming to those meetings, you're missing out.
How about you, Christina? Do you have another perspective on those questions?
No, I think Eileen covered it. I think engagement in social media is a great idea, and it's tactical and measurable too. So especially around things like Rare Disease Day, which just passed a couple of weeks ago, or November, which is Epilepsy Awareness Month. Those are opportunities for our members to engage again and drive sort of the hashtags to raise awareness about the rare epilepsies. So I think that's a great suggestion, Eileen. And as far as members getting involved, we are, just to put this out there, we are refreshing our website. So there will be easier navigation for those that are interested in learning more about REN to sort of see exactly what we're doing, and an easy way to sort of click through and find out how to join and become a member and all that good stuff too.
Awesome. Thank you both so much for the detailed download on all this important work. It's really exciting, and I know people are going to take a lot from this conversation. And yeah, again, share. The rare disease community rises by lifting others. So if that is the only capacity that you have right now in what you're doing in your life is to share stuff on social media, know that that is advocacy, and we'll take all the help we can get. So it is not a small thing to be able to spread it throughout your network. So, okay, well, thanks, Eileen. Thanks, Christina. It was so nice to chat with you. If there's anything else that I didn't ask or bring up or that you're thinking of now that we should have talked about, let me know.
No, I think you've covered everything.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you so much for having us and for helping us get the word out. We really appreciate amplifying.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for being my guest today, ladies.
Thank you, Effie.
Thank you.
I hope you've been enjoying this podcast. If you like what you hear, please share this show with your people, and please make sure to rate and review it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also head over to Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter to connect with me and stay updated on the show. If you're interested in sharing your story, or if you have anything you would like to contribute, please submit it to my website at effieparks.com. Thank you so much for listening to the show and for supporting me along the way. I appreciate y'all so much.
I don't know what kind of day you're having, but if you need a little pick-me-up, Ford's got you. Mm-hmm.